Our speaker tonight comes to us all the way from Sherman Oaks, California. He worried me a little bit, not him, and I just put it all in my HP's hands and said, if he's going to be here, fine, of the people that filled him out. But as usual, God comes through, and I heard this fellow in Hilton, and it was a real message that I needed at the time, but I needed to hear it a lot later than that. I got his tape, and I listened to it a lot. I formed a special relationship with a small plastic cassette, and I was finally glad to see him again, reintroduce myself. I hope you all get as much out of it. With no further ado, from Sherman Oaks, California, I give you...
Thank you. My name is Clint. I'm an alcoholic. And I'm delighted to be here. I'm delighted that I got invited by John and the committee to come back and talk at your... I'm impressed at the 45th annual Thanksgiving Bank. An easy trip. And Melvin met... He did good. It was interesting. I called into the office for messages this week, and my secretary said, you certainly have an interesting life. And I said, what do you mean? She said, well, there's a message here. I didn't know you were going to be in Cincinnati this weekend. There's a message here that somebody's going to meet you at the airport in Cincinnati, and he'll have a false leg and be holding a big book. She said, it sort of sounds like a Robert Ludlum novel, and I guess it does. And by God, there he was. They didn't tell me he'd be wearing an earring. In fact, I asked him about that. There's a lot of codes in California, and you just ask him about it. It turns out it's not an earring. And they tagged his ear and told him to come to AA for you guys to study it. But I appreciate it, Malcolm, very much. And he went and got Brenda. And last time I had a drink was the 14th of August, 1960, this year, 20 years of sobriety. And that's that's a surprise to everybody then, and to me too. This program works astonishingly well. And I know there's a lot of people here in their week, and I welcome you particularly. I welcome you because I love AA. I love getting a front row seat and watching what happens to the life. And I get a good feeling here in Cincinnati about it. I like the feeling. I'll tell you what the feeling is that I've had in just the hour that I've been among you, in just the hour that I have been feeling that there is a deep respect here for the program, Years of Sobriety, here tonight and still after that. This is the most extraordinary Lawson. So if you're new, welcome to Lawson. And I'd like to have everybody on the count of three, if you would, if you don't want to, but if you would, on the count of three, just take a deep breath. I shouldn't chew ice up here at the microphone. Make those tapes sound weird. I got to Alcoholics Anonymous because a bail bondsman brought me here. A rather inelegant way to get here, possibly, but that's the way it was in my life. A bail bondsman brought me to Alcoholics Anonymous. He'd never brought anybody before, and to my knowledge, he hasn't. And he's one of those people that's as surprised as I am that has had a drink. I call him every year on my birthday to thank him for a long time. It was kind of funny, because I'd say, Don, it's Clint, and there'd be that little pause. And he'd say, where are you, Clint? But now I think he kind of looks forward to my call and says, has it been another year? And I invited him to my 20th birthday party. It's been an extraordinary time for this 20 years. I got here when I was 29. I'm 49. And I feel than I did. When I got here, I was living in a garage in Glendale, California, a little suburb of Los Angeles out there. I was living in a garage with three other guys. Life was not good. It was a double garage, but still, you know, the pagan splendor of that didn't quite get it. And it was cut up into four rooms. I had a little room in that. about 8 by 10, and the way that male alcoholics live, and I've been in a lot of those rooms since I've been a member in good standing program, and they all seem to run about the same. I suppose there's much difference here in Senseless. They have a little cot, and they have a little chest or a wardrobe. They have a sink. There's a toilet down the hall. The toilet is just a rumor, you know. You got the sink, you don't really need the toilet. I'm living, isn't it? All I ever wanted in my life was to be cool. And I'm living in this little room. The linoleum floor is sticky. I mean, you can hear yourself walking across that linoleum floor. Wine and stuff spilled. There's a little narrow cot. There's a bad odor in that room. The odor of mattresses gone sour. I had a bad run of mattresses that spring. Little light bulb coming out of the ceiling on a cord. And that's it. That's it. You live and die in those little rooms. Oh, there's one more thing for a male alcoholic there. We don't give up our social life either. Yeah. Honey, I'm home. You know, one of those girls. Awful. Sometimes I woke up in that little room, and sometimes I woke up in the Glendale drunk tank, and it was all about the same. Except that it's kind of funny, and I think that many of you know what I'm talking about when I say that waking up in the drunk tank is somehow easier, in a way, once you realize where you are. See, if I wake up in the garage, I need a drink real bad, real bad. And when I wake up in the drunk tank, I don't need a drink quite so much. I know I'm not going to get one. And it's replaced by a certain predictability. I'm not going to get arrested. I guess you can get arrested in jail. I never did. It's somehow easier. It's amazing. In the book, it says, makes reference to that by saying that the most uncommon sort of living became commonplace to us. The goofiest set of circumstances we quickly accepted as normal. We adjusted to the most bizarre forms of what we thought of as reality, life, and an odd way of looking at things. Because it all had to be adjusted so that somehow my rationalizing the next drink wouldn't seem quite so absurd. In the face of overwhelming evidence that I can't drink, I justify the next drink. Evidence was overwhelming. I mean, for me to go to jail time and time and time again. And the price that we pay is the price that we pay. It's, we don't start out thinking that we're going to really pay much of a price for it, and yet we really do. I started, I had a relatively short career, I guess. I started drinking when I was 17 at a party. And when the party was over, I was 29. And as they say, when the party was over, the party was over. And in that 12 years, I paid the price that we pay. I stood on a street corner one morning in Glendale, afraid to step off the curb because I knew I would stumble and a truck would get me. We have a rich imagination, you know. And I stood there at 5 to 6 waiting for a bar to open up. And I remember with clarity a guy pulling up to the corner in a Lincoln, and he was wearing a suit and a tie. And I immediately assigned him a good job and a fan and all of that. And I knew that I could have those things, have to drink. And I knew that if he had to drink the way I have to drink, he couldn't have those things either. And I just knew that. It's almost like you walk into the bar one day and the guy says, today the price of the drink is $2 plus your car. My car. My car. Yeah. $2 and your car. You mean if I drink today, it'll cost me my car? Yeah, that's right. You want the drink? Well, yeah, I want the drink, but my car. I can get another car. It seems funny, you know. I remember my car just seized one day on a side street in Glendale. It just kind of froze up on me. I was saving up for an oil change, but The timing got a little bit bad. And then one day we walk in and the guy says, yeah, today it's $2 to drink and your job. My job? I'll lose my job if I drink today? Yeah, that's it. $2 to drink? Well, I think I'll go someplace where they appreciate me more anyway. I can always get another job. And on we go. One day we walk in and today the price of the drink is $2. And it'll cost you your wife. Okay. Some decisions are easier than others. And that's the way it goes. And so I don't think that I knew all that at age 17. I didn't take that first drink thinking that I would do all of that. And nobody really does. I grew up in one of those hellfire and brimstone homes. I grew up where we were taken to church 5 and 6 times a week and told to give our hearts to Jesus. And there, among all of the other things that we were told was we were told you don't drink under any circumstances, ever. You do not drink. My dad drank. Everybody pointed to him and that is just... So I had that kind of odd thing. My mother was very religious. My father was a drunk. And that conflict early on. I grew up with my mother's morals and my father's conduct. And it leaves you a little bit twisted somehow. And so when it came chance for me to drink, it was after a football game in high school. Vodka and orange juice. I didn't take that drink because I thought it would do for me what it did for me. And it did a lot. I took it because we weren't supposed to. And that kind of makes it, I don't think that's alcoholic, it's just the way we are as human beings. It's like Adam and Eve in the garden, you know, said don't eat the fruit. Now they weren't crazy for fruit, it's just they weren't supposed to, you know. Somebody said once they should have forbidden them the snake and they'd eaten that damn thing and saved us all a lot of trouble. Maybe. So I had that drink, and it did something for me that happened pretty quick. I didn't know why my dad drank. I thought he drank so he could be meaner, because that's what happened when he... But I'll tell you what it did for me. Up until that time, and since that time, I've got a problem going in my life. And the problem was put into words as well as I can put it into words by somebody else. I heard it after I got sober, and it just said it for me. Peggy Lee is singing that song, Is That All There Is? Is that it? Is that all there is? I mean, is that all I get out of life? Out of that job? Out of a relationship? Out of a Christmas? Out of the holidays? Is that it? And her solution is, you might as well keep on drinking, pass out, keep on dancing and pass out booze. Might as well just kind of go unconscious with it, because awareness is not rewarding, because all you get on Christmas night after the gifts have been opened up is the feeling like, is that it? Is that all there is to Christmas? And it wasn't that the gifts were scroungy. They were, but I'm not going to bring that up. It's just that there's kind of, it's like sitting in church and hearing that sermon that stirs everybody. Is that it? It doesn't touch me. Somehow I don't allow it to touch me. Mentally, I'm in the back with my feet up on the next pew and my arms folded. I don't want anybody to get through to me. I got to live in neutral somehow. And I manage to do that and then look around and say, is that all there is? Is that it? My first son was born. People said, congratulations. For what? I don't want to be married, much less be a father. For what? Is that it? And you know what? After about 3 drinks or 4, there is a brief moment, especially if I know where the next 2 dozen drinks are coming from. There is a moment, a little window, a little passage of time, what's enough? It's just, it fills up holes in me that I don't even know are there. That's what booze did for me. And it did it, and it did it, and it did it. And when it stopped doing it, I knew that it would do it. I knew that it would do it. And it isn't even so much how it makes you feel as it is how it makes you think you're going to feel in about 10 minutes. That extraordinary promise that's involved. And I added, of course, dropped the pills. I did the uppers. I did the whole bit. Only the uppers were important to me because it allowed me to drink more and longer. And I could get up in the morning and not go through all of that business and get cooking again and then drink some more. I like those uppers. I like in those days, methamphetamine hydrochloride was kind of an experimental drug. It had been on the street for years, but medicine had just discovered it, and they thought it was new. They didn't know it was speed. And an intern in a hospital where I worked as an orderly gave me a lot of that stuff, and I loved it. I loved it. And so I had grown up in that kind of a feeling of there isn't enough out of life. I had grown up, I have an identical twin brother, and he and I grew up in the same home, and we took kind of divergent paths. I remember I was always ashamed of our home. I was ashamed of my father, and I was ashamed of the house we lived in. I was ashamed of my mother, and that stung because I was ashamed of being ashamed of her. The dog embarrassed. I remember, and we always moved. We moved a lot. We moved more often than the annual Thanksgiving banquet in Cincinnati moved. We moved a lot. We moved into Denver one year, and we lived on the wrong side of the tracks, and I was very ashamed of our house. And sometimes, and we went clear across town to school, and sometimes it was in the eighth grade after football practice. Some folks would give us a ride home in a Cadillac or, because they had money where we went to school, and they would drive us back over there, and it's just I hated to have them see the place. We'd get about six blocks from where we lived, and I would say, it's right around the corner, let me out here. And they would. I'd be glad to run six blocks home so they wouldn't see that rat hole we lived in. My brother would be in the car, and he'd say, no, it's down here about six blocks. Hey, he'd let him get right in front of the place, and he'd say, that's it. After I got sober, I asked him about, he's one of these, you know, we're identical twins. I'll tell you what kind of a guy he is. He eats breakfast. He fastens the seat belt. I don't think he does it maliciously, but he does, you know. So I asked him one day if he remembered those days, and he did. I said, didn't it bother you to have those people see that house we lived in? He said, you know, I never accepted the responsibility for the condition that I just wanted to slap him. We just took a little, and we're identical twins, and he grew up in the same home, and he reacted to things different. And so I talk about my background. I talk about that home. I talk about the religious upbringing and all of the little twists and turns that it created those. But it didn't, you know. It wasn't that. It was how I reacted to it. And I reacted to it by, I saw all the mixed messages. Like, God loves you, and you're going to burn forever. You know, not comforting much. There was one, I liked the one about sex. It was one of the hellfire and brimstone deals. A fundamental, and so the message about sex got colorful. Sex is filthy and disgusting and ugly, and you should save it for the one you really love. Oh, thanks, Mom. That helps. I don't think that causes alcoholism. It gives us something to work through after we get sober, I can tell you that. That's why we sit around a coffee shop so late at night. So I welcomed alcohol. It was not a problem. It was an answer. It was an answer. And in that 12-year span that I drank, I went to college. Brought a lot of money from in-laws and got a college education. Went to dental school for a couple of years, and they threw me out because I drank too much. I went from there into the Marine Corps and seemed to spend a lot of time standing in front of somebody's desk trying to explain. I got a commission. I went through OCS and I was commissioned an officer in the United States. And I liked that very much. That was really the first success that I had. And I was very pleased and proud to be a Marine officer. I only have one problem, and that is and it gave me good duty assignments. Sent to the West Coast, and they made me a staff member at a non-commissioned officer's leadership school, kind of a spit and polish showcase for Marines on the West Coast. And the staff there were very competent officers and good officers. And I enjoyed that job, except that eventually they took it away from me because I drank, and I drank too much. I mean, the Marines are hard-drinking people, and I drank more than was acceptable to them. And so I stood in front of the commanding general on a couple of occasions, and he read me a letter of reprimand. And it wasn't long before I was back in front of him, and he read me another letter of reprimand. And I stood at attention in his office in front of his desk one morning at El Toro, California, while he took excerpts of fitness reports that had been written about me and read them out loud. And they were not pleasant. One major got it all down in one sentence. He says, this lieutenant consistently fails to live up to the low standards he has set. Kind of a cold shot. And I knew, and he finally dismissed me. He said, Lieutenant, there isn't any room in the Marine Corps for an alcoholic. I couldn't believe he was talking like that. And he finally let me go, and I did an about face and walked out of his office, knowing that if I ever wanted a career in the Marine Corps, it was over. I mean, they let me stay till my tour of duty was up, but I would never have any reason to stick around. And when my tour of duty was over, I got out, and I moved to Glendale, and I started out living in an apartment. And by this time, I was alone. And then I moved into a car, and finally, I took up residence in the garage. And that's where I was when the bail bondsman brought me to you. I was selling encyclopedias door to door to earn enough money. And I was in and out of that Glendale jail. And I had some snotty attitudes. I'd been arrested a lot by this time. And I was one of those clowns that I was never guilty. I was never guilty. I got arrested for being drunk in public. I mean, I was not drunk. I was. It was like this. I wasn't drunk. If I remember the arrest, I wasn't drunk. Not guilty. I got arrested for bad checks. Not guilty. Who knew this one might go through? It could happen. I was arrested one morning at 10 a.m. for drunk driving. I'd been in a beer bar at 6 and nothing was happening. That is a bad day. That first time that happens to you, it is bad. You sit there and drink and expect something good to start happening and nothing happens, except you're all too clear, And so about 10 a.m., I got up and decided to go someplace and get some liquor. I was driving down the street. The light was red, so I stopped. Just a citizenship thing I do. And the light turned green and amber and red, green. I was resting there. Guy right behind me was in a cop. So pretty soon he's rapping on the window. I didn't see him coming, of course. But I just had, I've always kind of had an image in my mind about how he must have sauntered up there. And probably didn't even put on his hat. That's the only shade of green we have here in California, Slim. You're going to have to move on out. He asked me to get out of the car. And then he wanted me to touch my nose and things like that. And I can remember being so surprised that he arrested me. Not guilty. And I was into something. I want your badge number. A few weeks later, I read the police report. He said the field sobriety test was discontinued because the suspect was injuring himself. Not guilty. I want a jury trial. I have a sponsor. One of these step Nazis. His name is Clancy. Don't get ugly. He told me one time, I say I'm into justice. I want justice. After he heard my fifth step, he said, you really ought not go for justice. You've had about all the justice you can stand. Ask for mercy is what he said. You don't want any more justice. And that's the way it was. I remember hearing in an AA meeting something I did not want to hear. All I want to do is be cool. And somebody from a podium, a woman who later became a good friend of mine, said something I hadn't. She said, you can't get well in style. And I thought, oh. See, I want to just cross that stream at its narrowest point and go right up the other side and never look back. I'm trudge. I'm too cool for trudge. I woke up in that little garage one morning. It was still dark in the room, and I was under the bed. I was laying on the floor in there, on that sticky linoleum floor, and there was just enough light coming in under the door that I could see the rat over in the corner. And, you know, I knew that if I was kind of propped up on an elbow, and I thought if I move suddenly or even try to get up on the bed, that rat is going to be on me like a bag is, and he's going to take my ear or my eye. I had a rich imagination. And he and I looked at each other, and I'd come around again, and he'd still be there, and I'd leave, and I'd come back. I was just terrified. And I came back around again, and a little more light was coming in. It was first light, and there was a window, and there was more light coming into that. And I looked again, and that rat in some magical fashion had turned into a pair of socks laying upon me. And that's how cool I got. I was held hostage by a pair of socks all along the way. That's what's called alcoholism, is what that is. We laugh about it, you know, but in those bleak hours, in those terror-filled hours, nothing is funny. The joy has gone out of life. There is no joy in it. There isn't anything. It's just, and we think, you know, on that diet of snake pits and manure piles, we long for hope. And I knew it would end one day against a freeway abutment or someplace. Powerless. It's interesting. When I got here, you didn't ask me if I was alcoholic, and I was braced for that question. You wanted to know if I was powerless over alcohol. And it's interesting. I was not braced for that question because I didn't have a cute definition for powerless. Powerless is just, we all know, way down deep inside where we really live, powerless is when they say get hard. Powerless is put your hands behind your back. Powerless is when they take your finger and say, just relax, we'll do it. Because you can't quite get the fingerprinting process right either. And if alcohol and powerless touch in your life, welcome. Welcome home. Welcome. It's not a big deal, except that it's a beginning to know that powerless and alcohol come together. If they do for you, I've got good news for you. There's an answer, and it is here. You have found the answer. I never dreamed that the answer would be here. When that bail bondsman told me that he was taking me to alcoholism, if I'd had anything left in me, I would have said, no, sir. And I had nothing. I was done. I was just flat done. And he brought me to you. It's been 20 years now. And my life is extraordinary. I love being sober. I love being a member of AA. I love the changes that you have brought up. I'm no longer helpless. but then I no longer drink. I didn't know, and I sometimes forget to say this, and I want to make it real clear if you're new here tonight. On the 14th of August, 1966, I had no idea that I had taken my last drink. No idea. I had quit a lot. If you're new, don't quit. Just don't drink today. If you have quit, God, you know a lot about quit. There's not much here about quitting. Really, there is not. If you're looking for a way to quit drinking, this is not going to do it for you. Because the truth of the matter is you can't quit if you're an alcoholic. But if you're looking for a way to learn to live so that you never have to start again, make it real clear if you're new here tonight. On the 14th of August, 1966, I had no idea that I had taken my last drink. No idea. I had quit a lot. If you're new, don't quit. Just don't drink today. If you have quit, God, you know a lot about quitting. There's not much here about quitting. Really, there is not. If you're looking for a way to quit drinking, this is not going to do it for you either. Because the truth of the matter is you can't quit if you're an alcoholic. But if you're looking for a way to learn to live so that you never have to start again, then my life is extraordinary. I love being sober. I love being a member of AA. I love what you have done. I love the changes that you have brought about in my life. I'm no longer helpless, but then I no longer drink. I didn't know, and I sometimes forget to say this, and I want to make it real clear if you're new here tonight. On the 14th of August, 1966, I had no idea that I had taken my last drink. No idea. I had quit a lot. If you're new, don't quit. Just don't drink today. If you have quit, God, you know a lot about quit. There's not much here about quitting. Really, there is not. If you're looking for a way to quit drinking, this is not going to do it for you either. Because the truth of the matter is you can't quit if you're an alcoholic. But if you're looking for a way to learn to live so that you never have to start again, welcome. That's what this is. And I didn't get that for a while. That had to be explained to me. I did not know on the 14th of August, 1966, I'd had my last drink. And I think it's just as well. If I'd have known that with my last drink, I'd have probably had two. You know. And John would have gotten another speaker out here tonight. My progress in AA was not rapid. I got a lot of attitudes. I knew a lot of things that were not true. I had a silly idea that I could manage my life. I thought that sobriety had something to do with what I deserved, and I don't deserve to be sober by my account of it at that time. And if you're plagued with that, if you have a secret gnawing sense inside of you that you don't deserve it, that you, among all of the people, among the 780 of us here, if you know that you're the one that does not deserve this thing, and so you might as well go out, I got good news for you. It doesn't turn on what you deserve. It just simply doesn't. It isn't that we don't deserve it. It's that it doesn't much matter. And I'll tell you how I figure that. And this is my opinion. The last time, on the 14th of August, 1966, I was a drunk. It was the last day I had a drink, and on that day I was a drunk. On the 15th of August, 1966, I was not a drunk. Now that's rapid movement. I mean, it happens in a day. I can't believe that I deserved anything more on the 15th than I did on the 14th. I don't think I deserved anything less on the 14th. It isn't about what I deserved. I'll tell you what it was. I went to a meeting and somebody said something to me that touched me. This guy in that club in Glendale said, you don't ever have to take another drink again, a day at a time, as long as you live, if you do not want to. In effect, he gave me a choice. And you have the choice, too. We all do. We all exercise that choice on a daily basis. And the choice is simply whether I'm going to be drunk or sober, because we know there's nothing in between. And so we don't get what we deserve. We get what we choose. It's just as simple as that. And this whole program is extraordinarily simple. It's about living a day at a time without taking a drink. Postponing one drink one day is really what it amounts to. That's what it's about. And then the key becomes, how do you do that? How on earth do you do that? When I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had so much going on in my head that it made me crazy. I go to bed at night and I stare at the ceiling. And all of that stuff, all of those nickel and dime compromises in my life run around up there. Those old tapes begin to play and I don't have anything to, I don't understand. I can't explain my behavior. I did the goofiest things. I got drunk at precisely the wrong time. I told the, I remember, the, you know, and it's funny. I was arrested a lot and I stood up in front of that Glendale Municipal Court judge a lot and said not guilty a lot and made my deal with the court a lot. But it really was never the things I got arrested for that bothered me. I'll tell you what bothered me. The night I stole $5 out of somebody's purse in a bar. The night I saw, it just made me, she got up to play the jukebox and I needed a drink. I remember one night, and this is one of those little nickel and dime secrets that I brought into Alcoholics Anonymous with me that just drove me crazy. I was married. I was living at home with my wife and little boy. And I was out on the town looking for her. And I didn't hang out at the library looking for her. I got out there where she was. I have a good friend named Cliff. He says he never came out of the blackout to discover he'd spent the weekend helping the poor. And I didn't either. I'm out there doing it. I was on active duty in the Marines at that time. My job was an air observer. I flew in the left seat of a helicopter in the back seat of an F-4, and I observed the air is what I did. Well, when I got on Liberty and had a couple of martinis, I became a pilot. A fighter pilot. Cold-blooded, steely-eyed, sex-crazed professional killer. And I'm at this party. And I'm holding my hands like that and telling my war story. And I found her. She was there. God, I just almost brought tears to my eyes. There was some soul connection there. Oh, it was just wonderful. We were doing so well. I mean, it was just... She was just a remarkable person. I'd known her 12, 13 minutes by this time. And we were, and out of nowhere, she said, "How come you're drinking so much?" Well, I knew she wasn't the right one after all, you know. But I said something that I could never forget. I never got it out of my mind. My response to her was a lie. I said, because I'm not prepared for that question. And I said that the reason I'm drinking so much is because my wife and little boy were killed not long ago in a car wreck. And I woke up with that lie in my head. I knew that a man would not deny the existence of his family just to impress some person at a party. I mean, it was a demeaning thing. It'll never be on a police blotter. My point is, the stuff that I brought into Alcoholics Anonymous is little stuff, and I think that it'll go away somehow. I can safely sweep it under the carpet. It'll disappear. I'll never really have to deal with it. And those little secrets have a lot of power over me, and they occupy my mind, and I can't get them out of my mind, and I got a bag full of that kind of stuff. And I know a lot of people in AA. And I have sponsored a lot of people, and I have heard a lot of fifth steps. And every man that I know, and I think it must be true of the women too, comes in here carrying a heavy, heavy bag of nickel and dime secrets. It makes us crazy. And we can't get rid of them, not really. They are what we see life through. our perception of the world around us is filtered through that gunk, and it makes it hard to get to sleep at night. Guy from California that died sober after many, many, many years of sobriety, Chuck C., used to say he had a grand central head when he got sober, and I know what that is. I remember going up to a guy when I was 5 days sober and saying, how do you get to sleep at night if you don't drink? He said, you really want to know? And I said, yes. He said, you want to get to sleep? And I said, yeah. And he said, where do you live? And I said, I live down the street. I didn't tell him a garage. I'm too cool to tell him a garage. He said, I'll tell you what you can do. After you get home tonight, make your bed. And I thought. And then he said, yeah, really, put clean sheets on your bed. I wondered how he knew about those sheets. And then he said, after you get the bed made, get in it and say a prayer to yourself. Oh, I didn't want to hear about housekeeping hints and prayers. I grew up that way. I cut my eye teeth on that. Saying prayers doesn't work. I mean, we used to go to sleep and go to bed and say, now I lay me down to sleep. Not comforting when you get to that part about if I should die before I wake. That'll keep you awake a while working through that. And I got home back to my little garage, and I was thinking about this guy, and I was half annoyed with myself for even bothering him because he's, you know. But he knew about those sheets. The psychiatrist had never mentioned the sheets. The chaplain had never asked me if I made my bed. So I made the bed. And I got in it, and I started to say that silly prayer he told me to say. If God be for us, who can be against us? I knew it wouldn't work. Next thing I knew, it was 7 the next morning, and I'd slept all night long. And I don't think I woke up feeling very... I probably figured it's about time I got a night's sleep, you know. But I connected the two today. Yeah, I gave him a problem, gave me an answer, and I did what he told me to do. Not graciously and not believing it would work, but it didn't matter whether I thought it would work or not. But he quieted my head down for a little bit that night. And it seems to me that that's what this is about. If you're new here, you're going to be told, I suppose, to go to lots of meetings and to take the steps. The steps of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. The steps of that part of Chapter 5 read by Dan tonight. Good job reading those steps. We had a guy the other night in my home group that said, at some of these we barked. I like that. Go to lots of meetings and work these steps. Now, why would that have anything to do with anything? It seems to me tonight that there's a reason that that has something to do with it. There's something about being in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous that is wonderfully refreshing. It's the only safe place in town. It's not safe on the streets. It's not safe in school or in church or at home. It's safe in a meeting of AA, and we calm down a little bit. There's something else that happens in a meeting of AA. See, I can be one of two places, generally speaking. I can be here in the room with you, or I can be up here visiting my problems in my head. And I just, it's like having a tooth missing. I can't keep my tongue out of it. And I go up here to my head, and I look around. And what do I see? Problems. And why is that so attractive to me? Well, I think it's because who would I be without my problems? And so I get my problems all collected. I got a problem. I got a problem. And we gather a crowd around. We discuss my problem. Take snapshots of it and look at it from all kinds of angles. I love having a problem. Somebody says, I got a solution. Not yet. Not yet. What a problem. It's a way for me to be self-obsessed, socially acceptably, in AA. I have lots of problems. Love them. It was fun, and it, you know, the passage of time doesn't really, I just have to laugh at it a little more. Not long ago, I was had a rather colorful morning and got into a big thing with a guy. And then along came a good friend of mine, and we went to lunch. And Tom and I were having a high hilarity at lunch. I love this guy like a rainbow, and he and I were just having a lot of fun. And in the middle of it, it occurred to me, what was I mad about? What? I was upset. Oh, there it is. Oh, thank God I forgot. Oh. That almost got away from me. I left Tom sitting there alone, and I went whooped up into my head, and I'm looking around, you know. That's my choices. And I'll tell you what, reality isn't up here. It's here in the room. This is reality, the people and the chairs and all of it. This is it, here. In the book, it says it this way. It says, nothing ever happened to me that was so bad that it made me drink. But the fear of what would happen tomorrow, or remorse over what happened yesterday, got the job done many times. That's what I'm talking about. And so we can be one of two places. We can be here in the room with one another, or we can be up here in our head. If we're here in the room, we don't have to drink. If I'm up here in my head, I have no... See, the whole point of it, going visiting, is that those problems are without solution. That's the wonder of worry. Worry is a dramatization of all those problems, and you'll notice that it has no solution attached to it. And you stay away from people that have solutions. My sponsor used to say, oh, you're going to go home and get caught up on your worrying, are you? I can be one place to the other. The wonderful thing about going to a meeting of AA is that for a little bit in almost every meeting I've ever gone to, I get in the room. Somebody will say something that'll bring me into the room. Do I stay there? Of course not. I don't want to abandon my problems altogether. I remember when somebody said, and this is years ago, I heard a guy say that he always had the feeling that other people got secret instruction in how to get along in this world that he never got. God, he had me in the room in a hot second. I knew exactly what he was talking about. I just was in the room. And sooner or later, somebody in a meeting will say something, and we get into the room, and we get a little relief from all of this stuff that's up there. See, this, it's so interesting. This is a survival mechanism, I think. I think the brain is designed to do something about survival, but we're not in survival. We're just, it's like, if the house is on fire, the brain is wonderful. It says, get out of the house. Good job, brain. But it hates to be out of a job. So it's always saying the house is on fire. Yeah. But there's something about being at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous that gives us a little relief from that. I remember sitting in a meeting one day, and a good friend of mine, a lady that I had come to respect, and she was one of these people, and I was sober maybe a year and a half, and she was a little bit ahead of me, and she was talking, and I loved to see her at a meeting, not because she was pretty, although she was, or stylish, or bright, but I liked to see her at a meeting because she looked skeptical. And I figured if she was going for this deal, maybe it would be safe for me to do it. She and I never really became friends, but I just, you know, I like to see her at a meeting when I got to a meeting. And she's at the podium one night, and she's talking about the alcoholic's prayer. And she described a scene that occurred in a Hollywood apartment where she lived, where she came out of a blackout sitting on the mantel over the fireplace with her cat. And there was a little cat food and vodka up there, a little something for everybody, you know. And the reason they were sitting up there is that there was about 8 inches of water on the floor. And that was because she had started to take a bath last Tuesday and the whole deal had gotten away from her somehow. Oh, she's my kind of girl, you know. I like, yeah. But she got me in the room with that. I remember one night sitting in a meeting in Brentwood, and the guy that wrote the talk that was later reduced to a pamphlet called The Members' Eye View of AA. I don't know if you've read that pamphlet or not. It's a remarkable thing. The presentation he gave at UCLA, a guy named Alan, he has since died sober. He's at the podium at a workshop answering questions, and somebody wants to know about the 11th step and about a conscious contact with God, and he said something that got me in the room, and I've never forgotten that he said this. He said that there's only one time that any of us can have a conscious contact with God. And I expected him to say when we're on a 12-step call, or when we're loving someone, or being of service, or allowing somebody to love us, or communicating, or something like that. Those ideas go through your head rapid fire. And he said there's only one time that any of us can have a conscious contact with God. And that's right now. Right now. I mean, it's like getting a room. Say it here. We don't need to drink here. So if you go to a lot of meetings, you get a shot at being in the room. You get a little relief. Why do you want relief from this? Because there's nothing happening up there that has anything to do with reality or that you can do anything about, really. It's just unreal pictures of yesterday and tomorrow. And you figure out after a while, if you stay in the room, that either you never had a problem at all or you had the solution all the time. So you kind of got to get in the room to get that. And so the meetings are important because they give us some relief. Now you'll also be told to take the steps. What if there was some way? We're looking now for a way to quiet this mind down. We're looking now for a way to do something about so we can stay in the room as much as possible. And we can't stay in the room if there's all that noise going on up there. I was laughing because we get this thing going. A friend of mine was talking and he was saying that he'd been at a party earlier and somebody came up to him, it was at somebody's home, and said, there's a gal over here that's as cute as she can be. She's from Nicaragua and I want you to meet her. And they're walking across the room. She's sitting on the couch on the other side of the room, and by golly, she was cute. And what's in his mind as he's walking over there is, I don't want to live in Nicaragua. Now, how are the steps going to do that? Well, what if there was some way to take all that crud that's running around up there, all that noise, and take a pencil and a piece of paper and write it down? That'd give you some relief, wouldn't it? It'd start to drain the swamp a little bit. You'd get it at least down. Those of you that have done that know that that's exactly what happens. It begins to, those ideas don't look as bad on paper. You begin to see that they're not really as powerful as they were running around up here without any form and substance. If you write it all down, why it doesn't matter much what format you use. And we put it off and put it off waiting for somebody to explain to us what format to use. I sponsored a guy that was saving up for a typewriter. And then he was going to take typing lessons. We avoid that like the plague, but if we write that stuff down, and you know, it doesn't take that long. It's just a good inventory takes, what was it somebody said not long ago, it takes 10 months and 45 minutes. It takes a year and a half and about an hour. You know, we agonize for a year and a half, and when we finally get to it, and of course, like everybody, I called my sponsor. I knew it. I wanted to set aside 3 days so we could go over this stuff. But if you get it down on paper, it begins to kind of calm down the head. What if there was some way then to take what you got down there on that paper, all of those ideas, the crazy ones and the noble ones and the stupid ones and the silly ones and the guilty ones and the fearful ones, all of it, and read it to somebody else. That's step five. That would further expunge it and make it less powerful in our minds, especially if you read it to somebody that understands what's going on and shares similar experiences with you. What if there's some way then to sift through that stuff and look for patterns in our lives? Look for how we have contributed to the problem. Look how we have brought the problems into our lives by our own conduct. We spend a lot of time in AA talking about how to handle resentment. But you know, there's something else that we can do. A resentment is my response to somebody that does or says something that I don't like, or that makes me feel stupid, or that makes me feel invisible or unimportant or threatened in some way. And what I've been looking at lately is not how to deal with the resentment, but to locate what I did to cause that person to say or do whatever I'm so angry about. Once I got that located, I'm in business. I can accept responsibility for it. I don't have to have the resentment of that person. And it's always like that. It isn't the guy in the next lane on the freeway. I want it to be. It isn't the elevator operator. I want it to be. It isn't. It's me. It's me. I have the responsibility for everything. In the book, it says this. It says, it's spiritually axiomatic that whenever we're upset, there's something wrong with us. God, I hated that. That's tough sledding for me. I don't want that to be the case. And yet, what if it really were the guy in the next lane? That'd be a nasty world to live in. There's no greater evidence in my mind of a loving God than the fact that it is not the guy in the next lane. He's given me everything I need to have a quiet heart and a wonderful life, including the capacity to ask for help and recognize my responsibility for the problems that are in my life. What if there was some way then to assign those character defects their right name and accept responsibility for them? What if there was some way to make a list of the people that I'm afraid are going to come get me? That's all that floating anxiety is about. That's that free-form fear. It's just guilt. It's just the knowledge that sooner or later I'm going to get off an elevator and there they'll be. All of them. Make a list of them. It'll quiet your head down. Become willing to make amends to them. It'll quiet you down. Make those amends. It's step 9 now we're at. The whole point of the exercise tonight, and this is my opinion, seems to me to be to quiet my head down. Why do I want to do that? So I can be in the room with you. Because I'm going to be up here tending to problems or out here living my life. I don't seem to have much of a choice. I have, and it has worked for me in an extraordinary way. Do I do it all the time? Oh, no. No, I just told you about that lunch with Tom. Why relationships get so goofy? Do I stay in the now? Do I figure out who I'm doing business with today? No. I work like heck to find out who she is so I can put her in a box in case I ever need her. And I never look again. Chamberlain used to say he woke up with a different woman every morning because he looked every day. He was a wonderful guy. He was one of these right now guys. I remember one time I was driving to a meeting, and we had plenty of time, but I said, Chuck, if we take this road down here, we can save 15 minutes. He said, what are you going to do with it? I said, oh, right, right. Around Chuck, you went right. One time I said, Chuck, how can you stand to drive up to L.A. in all that traffic just to talk at a meeting? You do it 4 times a week, and he was past 70. I said, how can you stand to go up there in all that traffic? He said, I just drive the one car, son. When I was 5 years sober, I had a chance to do something I never thought I would have a chance to do. Somebody told me, I didn't like selling carpet, which is what I was doing, and somebody said, you ought to go to law school. I thought, oh boy, I don't think so. But I promised I'd look into it, and I did. It takes 4 years. I have to go at night. I got to work during the day. Got to pay child support and do all that stuff. But I got to go to meetings at night. And I went back and I said, you know how old I'll be in 4 years if I go to law school? How old will you be in 4 years if you don't go to law school? I was 5 years sober, 34 years old. It was 1971. Okay, I'll try one semester. I got hooked someplace in the middle of that semester. And those 4 years went by. And I was, in 75, there were a lot of AA members at the stadium at Whittier College in Los Angeles, in that amphitheater there. And I graduated, and then I had to take the bar examination, which is in California, 3 days, and it's a tough exam. About 27 or 28% passed it last time. Grueling 3 days. But you know, as colorful as that was, there was another stumbling block for me, and that is to fill out the application that the state of California wants me to fill out to take the bar examination. They asked some really awkward questions. like, have you ever been arrested for anything other than a minor traffic accident? And then they leave three little lines there. You know. See attached page, right? Here's one that'll knock you out. List your residence addresses since you were 16 years old. My study buddy had two addresses that covered it all for him. I had columns of addresses. 2 weeks here, a month there. The Pontiac, I had to list. I didn't want to put all that stuff down. I went to my sponsor and I said, you know, there's some stuff, I put it down, a lot of it, but there's some stuff that they'll never find out about. I don't know why, but that night I got arrested when I high-centered my car in the rock garden. It's not on the rap sheet. Oh, he said, did they just ask for what's on the rap sheet? And I said, well, no. And I thought I was going to hear a whole thing about morality and stuff. He pointed out how practical this thing is. He said, you don't have to put it down there. But if you don't, you won't pass the bar exam. I said, what? He said, oh, for you, it'll work like this. You won't put it down there, and you'll send all that stuff in, and you will know someplace in the back of your mind that they're going to catch you. And so you will know it's pointless to get ready for the bar exam. And so you'll go through a lot of stupid motions, and you won't get ready for it, and you'll take the exam, and you'll flunk it. On the other hand, he said, I know you want to pass it. And if you put everything down there, everything, they may not let you take it. But if they do, you'll be able to get ready for it. If they tell you to go ahead, you'll be able to give it everything you have. And I knew he was right. I knew he had me. And I wrote it all down there, every bit of it. And I don't look that cute on paper, I'll tell you. And I bundled it all up with twine and sent it up there to them. And they let me take their test. And I sat down in town Los Angeles in the convention center with 3,000 men and women and scribbled like crazy for 3 days and put my pencil down and went to a meeting of AA. And I had to wait 4 months to hand grade that stuff. I had to wait 4 months to find out if I'd passed or not. I didn't do that a day at a time. Spent a lot of time up here. And on Thanksgiving Eve in 1975, I got a call from a guy I sponsored that worked at a local newspaper, and he said, we got the list, and your name's on that list. What list is that you have, sir? But I had passed that, and it was astonishing to me. I remember on Thanksgiving morning at breakfast, I cried. They wouldn't give me a license to drive a car when you found me. 9 years later, they gave me a license to practice law in the state of California. And by that afternoon, I was thinking, you know, they really ought to tighten it up to keep those dummies out of this. That arrogance comes pretty quick. I love it. I love doing that. I love it. But I love being sober. I love it being here with you tonight. On the airplane, I gave a talk. My mind leaped ahead for about, you know, whatever, 3 or 4 hours ahead. Tomorrow, I'll come back, give another talk. But tonight, I know this. I know that I'm here, and I'm here in the room, and I got all the help I need. When I come back tomorrow, I'll be alone, and I won't have any help, and I will remember to get into wherever I am and do what I'm doing and be safe. But I also know this. I'm glad to have been in this room with you tonight and to have celebrated your 45th anniversary. Thank you. There's only one thing I can really say, and that's thank you, Clint, very, very much. John T. has done the taping. He'll have order blanks for anybody that's interested in getting the tape of the talk tonight. We have a very beautiful way of closing our meetings here in Cincinnati, and that's to hold hands and say the Lord's Prayer. Afterwards, we have some dancing, plenty of beverages still. Enjoy yourselves. Let's enjoy the evening. thank you very much. The Lord's Prayer.